You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and coming up, we weigh the claims made by the newly created Weaponization of Government subcommittee in the U.S. House against the evidence they've presented so far and get some historical perspective on their ongoing investigations. Now, a checkup on Wisconsin's nurses. Even prior to the pandemic, the Department of Workforce Development was forecasting a 2020 shortage of about 2,800 registered nurses across the state. And add the pandemic, and play that forward 15 years, and we could be looking at a nurse shortage closer to 20,000. That, according to the dean of the College of Health Education and Social Welfare at UW-Green Bay. How can we account for this growing shortage? And what can we do about it? What's being done about it? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Nurses, those in the healthcare field, we'd love to hear from you this half hour. Have you recently left the healthcare field? We'd love your perspective on the profession today. Have you considered leaving? What was it that made you leave or stay? And what do you love about nursing? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Gina Denick-Champion, is the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Welcome to Central Time, Gina.
Thank you, Lee, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Jill Guttormson is Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Lee.
And Gina, I'll start with you. I mentioned 2020 and 2035 with the nurses shortage. Where are we right now in 2023 with regards to the nurse numbers in Wisconsin?
Well, you can still probably ask any nurse that's working. Will tell you that the staffing shortages are there and they're real, and that when they talk about why their colleagues have left. Many talk about, the reason is not only sort of the physical demands, but the other role of a nurse when we've been taught to be a nurse is that whole intention piece. And the intention piece is the ability to meet and support your patients and talk with them and their family members. And that's the piece that they're missing, that they feel is one of the most important roles that they have in healthcare.
So it's the time to care for others, and that time's being squeezed. Was this something that you could say saw pre-pandemic, Gina?
Nurses will report that, yes, they were beginning to see that and feel that. And there was just, a lot of let's try and redesign, but it still left nurses feeling uncomfortable with that ability to spend time with their patients. And of course, with COVID, no one got to talk to the family member unless it was through virtual. And just the demands of the care of those particular individuals were pretty traumatic to many. And is what they're even seeing now, not so much the COVID, but the people that have taken way too long to go back to see their healthcare provider are coming in, with multiple chronic illnesses. And again, the nurse trying to manage all of that, both meeting the tasks of the job, the critical thinking, but also the needs to want to meet and help support that patient.
And before we get to Jill, just one more question here, Gina, from your perspective, leading the Wisconsin Nurses Association, what does this mean for patients and patient care?
I think that's where the moral injury is coming in for nurses, is that they're feeling that they're not doing what they want to be able to do in their role. I think what we're hearing a lot more about patient verbal abuse towards nurses, and in some cases, even the physical abuse. And that, we think, is that they're feeling that no one is there to take care of them. They're not there when they need them. The nurses are torn because they have multiple, their patient load is pretty high. And we're thinking that's why the sort of the anger and the frustration is coming out. When we think about a person in the hospital setting that, they are in probably the most vulnerable state they will ever be when you think about in a hospital, because you're there because you need healthcare services, and most of it provided, 24 hours a day with the nurse at the bedside.
That's Gina Denick-Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Also joining us, Jill Guttormson, is Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing. And Jill, has there been a similar dip in nursing school applicants or graduates?
So actually, our applicant pool has been relatively stable. The main problem in increasing the nursing workforce is that we have a lot of qualified applicants and not enough slots. So we've just recently increased our incoming class from 150 to 200 a year. But that requires really strong faculty, really strong clinical sites. And those are all resources that can be really hard to fill. And so there's a lot of work being done to try and increase nursing faculty so that qualified applicants who apply to nursing have a slot and can be trained as nurses.
And if you were to project out our nursing faculty and the teachers that would empower the next generation of nurses, what does that population look like right now? And how does it project into the future, Jill?
So we have a really impending nursing faculty shortage as well. The nursing faculty average age is over the age of 50. So nearing some of them in their 60s, nearing retirement. And so we have been working hard to get faculty interested, engaged, current clinical nurses interested, engaged in training the next generation of nurses. We have some funding from the state right now, nursing faculty workforce, that is allowing us to help support nurses coming back to school. It covers their loans, it covers their cost of the education so that they can come out debt-free and move into a faculty role. And this is incredibly vitally important. Every school of nursing in the state is at capacity with our current faculty, and we need to expand our faculty to expand our ability to train new, high quality, ready for practice nurses.
So just to recap briefly, make sure I understand things correctly. We have more nursing applicants than we can actually educate right now. We have a shortage of nursing faculty, and that shortage is only going to get greater as we go through time. And this, in turn, and in part, is producing a nurse shortage in Wisconsin, which, again, is only going to grow larger over time. Do I have that about right?
You do. And I think the other thing to add in is there is currently beginning to be nursing shortage, not adequate staffing, as Gina mentioned. We need to train new nurses, get them out into the workforce, and help alleviate that stressor on the current nursing workforce. And so it becomes a global problem. Nurses are leaving because they're burned out. They can't do the work that they know they want to do at the best, highest level of their license because of some of the stressors in the workforce. And we can't prepare nurses fast enough because of the stressors in academics. And so we really need to look at this for global solutions on the training side. And then also, how do we help nurses be resilient? How do we help them stay in practice so they can serve their communities?
That's Jill Guttormson, Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing. Also joining us, Gina Denick Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. And you can see how the problem is laid out here. You're welcome to join us. And if you are in the healthcare profession, we'd be interested in what you see through your experiences and your work every day at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're Kenneth and Beloit standing by. Kenneth, good afternoon.
Hello. You, in your introduction, said 20,000 some odd nurses would be short that many. And I wondered what that number included, CNAs, LPNs, RNs, PhDs.
Yeah, that number came from the Dean of the College of Health Education and Social Welfare at UW-Green Bay. And Jill, what do we know about those numbers and the projected shortfall of nurses in the future? And I believe that was by 2035, according to the dean.
Yes, so that is nurses among different professions and different parts of practice, but the majority of them are RNs, and the majority of RNs work in acute care. So we really see the shortage most globally in acute care.
Gina, let me ask you this question. There was a story at the end of last year from the New York Times where an investigation found that hospitals, according to the New York Times, helped lay some of the groundwork for the labor crisis long before the pandemic started, looking to bolster their bottom lines. It is a business, and hospitals sought to try to get more out of less. This, according to New York Times investigation. Is this something that we would see as part of the problem and part of the nurses' shortage, Gina?
Yes. I think it's, you know, productivity is obviously very important. You know, there's the need to right now not having the bed capacity, which as these people come from the ER into waiting for those beds. So you have the ER nursing staff that is, incredibly overwhelmed. We also have once they get into a bed, we were not seeing as much staff as, we thought was important to provide that care. And, then with COVID, the perfect storm moved on. But the numbers, I want to say the demand was already being identified prior to COVID. And I want to say that, our nurse execs in those systems were trying, to figure out how else can we redesign this? What else does that registered nurse need to be able to take care of their patients in, the best way that they can? And I think, again, that's where we kind of saw with COVID the stress of, the age of the nurse leaving because they didn't have the physical abilities anymore. The new grads not being able to be onboarded as well as they could begin because of the demand. And just a lot of things. Registered nurses are just in a lot of different places. So the demand certainly is there because they're finding places that are maybe they perceive as less stressful.
Gina Denick, Champions Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, also joining us for the discussion. Jill Guttormson, Dean of the Marquette University College of Nursing, and you as well at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about Wisconsin's growing shortage of nurses, nurse faculty, and what that means for healthcare in our state. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk about Wisconsin's growing nursing shortage with Gina Denick, Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, and Jill Guttormson, Dean of the Marquette University College of Nursing. And we want to hear from you as well at 1-800-642-1234, where Mike's driving through Wisconsin. Mike, good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for having this important issue on your program. The reason they don't have enough faculty is because an RN needs to get her master's to teach, and they don't want to pay as much as they could make out in the field. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that the medical profession is all about profits, and these hospitals are making enormous profits, but the part of it is they are intentionally understaffing. As a travel nurse in Chico, California, at a small hospital in PCU, you never had more than three patients on the day shift. Your charge nurse did not take patients. They were there to back you up. They had another nurse they called a ninja nurse who would just go anywhere where there was a need. And the most amazing thing is they had a break nurse that would come to you and say, time for your lunch or time for your break. I'm taking over your patients, which never happens everywhere else. You go to your friend and you say, can you please watch my five patients in PCU along with your five patients? So not only are they more stressed out, your patients get worse care.
Mike, I very much appreciate that perspective from a traveling nurse. And let's take it a little bit backwards there with the profit and understaffing. When you hear about that small hospital in Chico, California, Gina Denick, Champion, what are your thoughts?
So California was one of those states where they had mandatory ratios of RNs to patients. Oh. And you heard that the 3-to-1, that's not what is taking place in Wisconsin. We do have had conversations about being able to demonstrate that the patient assignments that the nurse has, you know, does reflect the, you know, the acuity of the patient. Oftentimes the patient that's in that bed when you start may not be the same patients that in that bed when you leave, because patients come and go all hours of the day. So it's some of this discharge planning, and then it's this big admission assessment. There's also, you know, the need for, and what we're seeing is a little more of the increase in the support staff for the registered nurse. But the problem is we don't have enough of the support staff either. I know that California was no different than any other state during the COVID pandemic, because even though you had those mandatory ratios, you could not find enough travel nurses. You could not find, so, you know, it's not that the beds closed, it's, you know, care went on. But, and I appreciate those nurses in California that rose to the occasion to take care of those individuals.
And Jill, let me ask you about the needing a master's to be in nursing faculty, and you can make more money as a nurse, so it's financially a disincentive. How do we make, how do we compel people to get into the nursing faculty field?
So I think there's a multi-pronged approach. One, it is true, you do need a master's to teach at a BSN or above level. Teaching in ADN programs requires only a bachelor's degree. So it depends on what program you're teaching in. I think it is really helping people see the value they bring and the immense joy that actually is present in helping prepare the next generation of nurses. Your influence is multiplied by so many when you can really impact the care that patients will receive through the nurses that you're training. I think it's important we look at joint practice models so that faculty can continue to practice and teach, which then can help increase their salary. And as I mentioned before, I think it's important that we look at ways that we offset the cost of the master's, of the DNP, of the PhD, so that nurses who want to come back to be educators aren't also bearing the cost of high loans for that education.
Lee, this is Gina, and if I could just share that we had, we were very successful in the last legislative session where we had $5 million was allocated to help support those nurses that wanted to become nurse educators. So it was a loan amount of either $30,000 to up to $50,000. It depended on the degree. And that rolled out in August of this summer, this past summer in 2022. And it feels as though we've had more than half of that $5 million has already been committed, if not more, to admitting those nurses. And that was despite there wasn't the ability to kind of market and really get it out there. But I think we've been very successful, or the schools have been very successful in recruiting those nurses.
I want to thank you both for joining us today. Gina Denick-Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, and Jill Guttormson, Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing, talking about the Wisconsin's growing shortage of nurses. Now, this semester's classes will be the last at the two-year University of Wisconsin campus known by locals as UW-Richland. In the 3 months since the UW system announced the news, a group of supporters have rallied to save the campus, and local officials in other parts of the state are asking whether their two-year campus might be next. Rich Kramer reports.
It was standing room only in late January in a classroom at the UW-Platteville-Richland campus. The community was there to pitch ideas on how to save the school that has seen enrollment fall to just 60 students. University officials and state lawmakers were there to listen. Like most who spoke, Alicia Woodhouse had family members attend UW-Richland. She said the thought of losing the opportunity for local kids to get a college education without spending thousands of dollars on a dorm room makes her feel sick.
First of all, I want to say how hurt I felt when I heard that this campus was closing, because it really felt like we were not worth it, like we had been discounted as a community.
Some speakers asked lawmakers to divert $4 million from the state's budget surplus to the campus. State Representative Tony Kurtz, a Republican from Waniwak, told the group he'd already mentioned the idea to some skeptical GOP colleagues.
So I am being brutally honest with you that I could probably persuade a few, but I know it would be a fruitless effort. because we would lose.
It wasn't the message community members wanted to hear, and the end of classes at Richland is already making other communities nervous. There are 12 other county-owned campuses like UW-Richland around the state, and they've all seen enrollment fall by an average of 57% over the past decade. During that time, state lawmakers cut $250 million from the UW system's budget. Since Richland's fate was announced, some county boards have delayed maintenance and upgrades at their schools. They want the UW system to promise that they won't close other campuses anytime soon. Marathon County Board Chair Kurt Gibbs says UW-Stevens Point at Wausau has been a critical source of quality education for the area, but the board is waiting for assurances before approving parts of a $6 million maintenance request.
Yeah, if the roof is leaking, we're going to fix the roof. There's no question. But when it comes to upgrading things effectively still in their life cycle, the board said, no, let's hold off.
Last month, a group of trustees made up of Outagamie and Winnebago County board members delayed a $4 million engineering study of a proposed dining facility expansion at UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities. Winnebago County Supervisor Stephen Binder told his board they need to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars.
Neither Outagamie County nor Winnebago County want to invest money in a building if we're not guaranteed that we're going to be there for at least 5 years.
UW officials say the Richland decision shouldn't be viewed as a sign of what's to come for other campuses. And Andrew Leavitt, chancellor at UW-Oshkosh, told WPR he has assured county leaders the Fox City campus isn't going away. Former UW system president Ray Cross hoped to delay these types of conversations when he merged the state's two-year and four-year campuses in 2018. The move saved money by cutting administrative staff, but that may have also come with unintended consequences. In Richland, locals say it meant the loss of their college recruiter. Cross wanted to merge the schools with the state's technical colleges, but the idea was fiercely opposed by local tech college boards. Now he says the legislature should have a conversation about making it happen.
Should we be like 95% of the rest of the states in this country and merge our technical and UW colleges? Is that the best solution? I think it is, but I doubt that they will have that conversation.
In a statement, the UW system said talks with community leaders around the state about the two-year campuses are underway. As for Richland, the statement doesn't suggest that the university will reverse its decision, but it does say a local technical college and high school could play a key role in the campus's long-term future. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is Central Time with a reminder you can respond to anything you hear on our station anytime by emailing ideas at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up tonight on 1A Plus, what happens when your local hospital closes? Jen White reports from California's rural Central Valley and hears more about the strain felt by many after one county hospital closed its doors late last year. That's tonight at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a key factor in Kevin McCarthy winning enough votes to become the 55th Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives was the guarantee of a new subcommittee to investigate the weaponization of the federal government. Congressman Jim Jordan, who chairs the subcommittee, claims to have spoken to dozens and dozens of whistleblowers. But after their second public hearing last Thursday, Democrats and some Republicans are arguing that the weaponization of government subcommittee has so far failed to produce any evidence that would justify its own existence. But that hasn't stopped committee member Matt Gaetz from calling for the abolishment of the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. That is, quote, if they don't come to heel. So we want to hear from you here. Have you followed the proceedings so far of this weaponization of government subcommittee? What do you think of what they have uncovered or what they have not? Have you seen any of the footage from it? 1-800-642-1234. Email us ideas at WPR.org. Sophia Kai is a congressional reporter at Axios. She contributes to the Axios Sneak Peek newsletter covering Capitol Hill, the White House, and elections. Sophia, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, great to be with you.
Let's start with the goals of this weaponization of government committee. What are they setting out to do here?
So, you know, I think this was the committee that a lot of conservatives and others affected from investigations into Russia, as well as, you know, this was, of course, was the Trump administration, and any election interference, as well as the Jan 6 investigation. These folks who were investigated are looking to make the claim that the U.S. government's, you know, the quote-unquote, the feds, DOJ, other intelligence agencies, are biased in their targeting of conservatives. And that is what they've set out to prove.
So what happened at this first public hearing of the Weaponization of Government subcommittee?
So, you know, at the first hearing, there were a lot of claims that were made. And the subcommittee, as you mentioned, is chaired by Jim Jordan, who was also the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, so the larger standing committee that it's housed under. And, you know, and Jordan made the statement that he has spoken to multiple whistleblowers, and he used the term whistleblowers who have evidence, you know, and these, he says, are current and former FBI officials that he says has, you know, the goods, meaning they can show that the FBI, DOJ, have engaged in these in these biases, whatever form that they come in. So he went and made this statement. And the report that you mentioned earlier is a report by Democrats on judiciary. And they put together, so they sit in on these behind the scenes transcribed interviews. So they too are present for testimonies behind the scenes where the witnesses are asked questions by staff in both parties. And what the Democratic report shows is that none of the three whistleblowers in question actually fall under the category of whistleblowers. And in fact, at least two were paid by, you know, a Trump confidant, Kash Patel, and, you know, and they argue that you know, it is a coordinated effort by the Trump, you know, the Trump campaign and, you know, and the Trump team to sort of influence what should otherwise be more objective investigations conducted by the Judiciary Committee and weaponization.
Sophia Kai, our guest, congressional reporter at Axios, and let's go now to the second public hearing held last week of Congressman Jordan's subcommittee. And let's hear a little bit of what took place from that committee. Here's Chairperson Jordan grilling a former Twitter executive, Yoel Roth.
FBI Special Agent Elvis Chan sends you an email. The email says this: heads up, I will be sending a teleporter link for you to download 10 documents. It's not spam. Please confirm receipt when you get it. 2 minutes later, 6:24 p.m., you respond back, received and downloaded, thanks. What were those 10 documents?
Twitter didn't give me access to my laptop, but Special Agent Chan has said publicly, and the FBI has confirmed, that those documents did not relate to Hunter Biden, and that's my recollection of them.
What did they relate to?
My interactions with Agent Chan and with the FBI almost entirely focused on what the FBI called malign foreign interference, things like Russian troll farms and Iranian involvement in the elections.
That from last week's public hearing from the subcommittee investigating the weaponization of the federal government. And Sophia Kai, how did that day play out? What else did we hear from the panel and the witnesses from that hearing?
So, you know, and this exchange here is a part of a broader effort by Republicans to show that there was coordination by the Biden administration and these tech companies, and particularly with regard to the story concerning Hunter Biden. You know, that is in question. And what you hear the witness here say is actually, look, my communication with the FBI had nothing to do with Hunter Biden. And this is, of course, under oath. So that is sort of the bigger picture of what that brief exchange was about. A lot of the hearing sort of went that way. And in fact, Democrats did their homework, you know, and they dug up some instances where the Trump administration had, you know, communications with tech companies, and they They played that out loud. They sort of put that into the congressional record. So there really was a back and forth. You know, remember, judiciary as well as oversight are stocked with members who are, you know, very interested in making news clips and making a name for themselves by making statements publicly in these hearings that will receive eyeballs. So you know, you did see some of that as well. You know, and we're talking about the more far right, more extreme conservatives on the committee. So, you know, you did see some of that as well.
Yeah, but Sophia, have we seen evidence? Have we heard from an actual whistleblower as defined to date? And if so, what have they said?
We have not. So we saw, and you know, and I've done a little bit of reporting here after these hearings that we talk about. And Jim Jordan really doubles down on his quest to find said whistleblowers that he's promised. And he really has this tendency to make statements and hope that his work and his investigations will be able to back them up. But essentially, he has sent out more threats to subpoena more whistleblowers. You know, right here, we're talking about, you know, more than 6 or 10, he is threatened with, you know, with a subpoena again, in hopes of finding someone who actually fits this description. And in addition to that, you know, with the tech companies, he has already subpoenaed 5 of them. He has also sent 3 subpoenas with regard to school boards. So basically, we're talking about this allegation by Republicans that, you know, DOJ was again biased in its investigations of parents who have threatened as well as harassed school board members for policies that they don't like, such as, you know, teachings about gender, teachings about race. And so in total, Jim Jordan has sent 8 subpoenas to date by per my count. Don't expect that to slow down. He has sent 95 oversight letters, and you know, and I've dug through these. Actually, more than half are basically sent to people who have signed the same documents. You know, so he is really trying to ramp up the numbers so that he can say, "Look, like this is the work that we've done," and that's because he's under pressure by both conservatives, you know, and criticism from Democrats that either he's not doing it fast enough, he's not doing it in an organized fashion, or he's not coming up with results. So, you know, that's kind of the broad trajectory of where Jim Jordan is headed.
Do we have another hearing on the calendar set yet?
I believe we do. So the House is out this week. Between weaponization and judiciary, we are expecting, you know, more hearings. I don't know off the top of my head exactly when the next weaponization hearing is, but judiciary and weaponization collectively, you know, I sort of think of them as one entity. Mm-hmm. They're looking at a dozen different probes. So, you know, Jim Jordan's staff, and he has a very small team of advisors, they're looking at about a dozen different things. And of course, some they'll prioritize more than others, but we expect more hearings about the border. We expect a lot more around this idea of, you know, a weaponized DOJ, you know, and there's a few others that they've not really dug into just yet, that they might, right? You mentioned ATFs, the opioid crisis, as well as ESG, and of course, Hunter Biden's laptop.
Sophia Kai, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us today.
Absolutely.
Sophia is a congressional reporter at Axios. She also contributes to the Axios Sneak Peek newsletter covering Capitol Hill, the White House, and elections. We're talking about the House of Representatives' weaponization of government subcommittee, the claims they've made so far, and the evidence they've presented to date. And we'll get your reaction at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we'll continue this conversation with some historical perspective on this subcommittee. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about the House of Representatives Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. We started with a look at the subcommittee's claims and weighed them against the evidence they've made public. Now let's get some historical perspective. The subcommittee styled itself after the Church Committee of the 1970s. They were created in the wake of President Nixon's resignation, and the Church Committee famously uncovered nefarious actions from both the FBI and the CIA. But the last surviving member of the Church Committee, former Senator Gary Hart, says that the agenda of today's weaponization of government subcommittee is, in his words, almost completely at odds with the purpose of the original Church Committee. Our next guest says comparisons and parallels to the weaponization of government subcommittee go back much further than the 1970s. John Cooper is a Woodrow Wilson scholar and a professor emeritus of American institutions at UW-Madison. And John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you, Lee. Nice to be here.
Yeah, and how far back in U.S. history can we go to find some parallels and similarities to today's weaponization of government subcommittee, John?
Well, the easy one, and I think one that probably people are going to hear a lot, and of course, this is Wisconsin, Joe McCarthy.
Ah.
But no, that's, in some ways, McCarthy was a latecomer to that. It really starts, as far as I can tell, right after the turn of the 20th century. Now, I'd be happy to have some historians of the 19th century correct me on this, but I think I've got this right. That's when Congress began to act more in public. Mm. Up to then, congressional committees had largely been private, not quite secret, but they didn't publicize themselves. And in fact, that was a major complaint. You mentioned Woodrow Wilson. His book, Congressional Government, has a long criticism that Congress is run by these committees that aren't accountable to anybody. And what the committees in those days would do was they would do what they wanted to do, their business, particularly pieces of legislation or something like that. And then presented to the floor of Congress, where it would get debated some, and if they had the right majority, passed. That changes in the 20th century, and it's really with the rise of mass media. Now, mass media in those days meant large circulation newspapers and magazines. It's not till you begin in the 1920s with radio, and then it takes off in the last 100 years. But before that, the earliest one that I can think of, and again, I can be corrected on this, was in 1911, a subcommittee of, I believe it was the House Banking Committee, investigated concentration of financial power. In other words, they went after this. This is a committee that it's looking to expose something. It's got a, you know, it's aimed at something that they don't like. At an, I won't say enemy exactly, but something that they deplore, and they're out for publicity. They want to publicize it. It was chaired by a congressman from Louisiana named Arsène Pujol. It's not, and most of these committees would then get the name of usually the committee chair. And what they did was they exposed an awful lot of, you know, what we would now say economic inequality, although by those standards, it was something very much like today, including it found that J.P. Morgan controlled $22 billion in capital, which made him potentially the largest single factor in the American economy. Even bigger than the government. So that's the kind of thing they did. Then in 1919, when Woodrow Wilson brought the peace treaty back, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, used the hearings on the treaty basically to poke holes in it and to find shortcomings and things that were wrong with it and to fuel up the opposition. Then another one, and you see, it can go on both sides.
Sure.
Then in the early 1920s, is after the right after the death of President Harding, you began to get the exposure of Teapot Dome, of the scandals that had gone on there. And what happened there, even though the Republicans were in power and controlled the Congress, they didn't have reliable majorities, especially in the Senate. And a Democrat, Senator Walsh of Montana, sort of took over that committee and exposed a lot of that. Then in the early 1930s, in the wake of the stock market crash and the Depression, the Senate Finance Committee had a series of hearings about what had happened on the financial markets, especially the stock market. And it was very much, again, muckraking and expose. That unusually was not named for the chairman. It was the chief counsel, a man named Pecora, Ferdinand Pecora. That's the Pecora Committee. Then in the middle of the 1930s, Senator Hugo Black of Alabama, later Justice Black, chaired a committee that went after the utility holding companies. And again, these are majority. The most famous one, I think, of the 1930s was the Nye Committee, named for its chair, Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. And what it did, it was looking backward, but very much with an eye to the present, about how we got into World War I. And specifically the influence of, well, they said the munitions industry, but they broadened it out, financial ties to the Allies and things like that. And these are, as you can see, expose.
Yeah.
Expose is what they're after.
John Cooper, let me reintroduce you for a second here. John Cooper, yeah. Our guest, Professor Emeritus of American Institutions at UW-Madison. And I want to move a little bit because this committee, sure. The Jordan Subcommittee, seems to have or claims to have styled itself after the Church Committee of the 1970s. Do we see any parallels there from your perspective, John?
Not much. No, I think Gary Hart is right. I think that the Church Committee... The church, yes, it was looking into the sins of not only Richard Nixon, but also Lyndon Johnson. In other words, things that had gotten us involved in the wars in Indochina. And, it was to publicize, but also they had a legislative intent, very much a legislative intent. I think that's the kind of distinction we have to bear in mind. You know, if you want to get into Joe McCarthy, as they say, he was a latecomer. The House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, was actually formed in the late 1930s, and it went after, right-wing Nazis as well as communists, but very much communists. And then after World War II, they really got going. That's where Richard Nixon, as a freshman congressman, got his start, was as a member of HUAC, and then they exposed Alger Hiss and that. And then Joe McCarthy comes in fairly late. He didn't have a subcommittee of his own until after 1952. That's when the Republicans took control of Congress and elected Eisenhower. And the interesting thing there is, unlike now, McCarthy was essentially going after his own party in power. And that's pretty much what led to his being brought down, reined in and brought down, was that he became as long as from the Republicans' point of view after World War II, as long as they were going after Democrats, going after the Truman administration, going after memories of Franklin Roosevelt, that was fine. But then, when he starts going after their own president, you know, he became a liability for them. One other thing that's interestingly is that. These uses of it, when I said mass media, this is still pretty much until the 1950s, you're still talking about print media and the kind of manipulation and scaremongering that, say, the Nye Committee did, particularly the Nye Committee in the 1930s, and then HUAC later, was manipulating the print media. In other words, the chair usually, the one who's running the show, would make some outrageous charges, and the newspapers would pick this up and have them in their editions, and then they would have some testimony and everything, and that the charges wouldn't be brought out. But so that would be page five in next day's paper. Meanwhile, the chair then makes another outrageous charge, and off you go again.
Well, it's very much a parallel to what we heard Sophia Kai talking about, how there are a fight for sound bites in this current government subcommittee investigating the weaponization of government. And John, I apologize. We're just out of time for this afternoon, but I thank you as always for joining us.
No, not at all. I hope this was helpful. You know, it's kind of like historians are always saying there's nothing new under the sun.
It comes back round again. John Cooper, Professor Emeritus of American Institutions at UW-Madison.